In chapter 12, the panoramic career of Satan, his campaign to ruin God's plan, and his epic failure is detailed. He is cast out of heaven into the earth. Chapter 13 now shows the climactic ending of his crusade against God. He brings his massive campaign to its zenith, attempting to defeat God and his people. He operates through humans by creating a powerful beast. We are introduced to this beast and find that it is both a great kingdom and an individual. The imagery of this chapter can be confusing if you read it alone or are unfamiliar with other key parallel passages. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 9, and Revelation 17 all help to bring clarity. When merged together and compared, they give complementary bits of information to help identify this beast. Who is the beast? Where did he come from? What will he do? The following key descriptions help identify him. Number one, the beast is weird. The beast is weird. Pastor Bob's laughing over here because he thinks he's weird. Well, you're not. You're just ugly, all right? There you go. Okay. The beast is weird. Notice its source, where it comes from in verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. So he rises from the sea, apparently refers to the sea of humanity. Those of you that have read our one commentary, he says that he believes it's from the Mediterranean Sea. But I don't believe that's true. He says it's one of the nations surrounding the Mediterranean. But this says he arises from the sea itself, not from a sea coast. And if you look at the Old Testament in Daniel, he uses that same description of arising from the sea. And Daniel, of course, is in Babylon, not in Israel. So it's the sea of humanity he rises out of the obscurity from a Gentile nation. Its sight, he is grotesque when you look at him. Seven heads and 10 horns, he is ugly. He is you don't want to be around him. Its significance, the 10 crowns are very important to understand. The blasphemy is on the seven heads, it says. In its identification, the beast is both a real person and a representative person. He is the leader of the final kingdom, much like Hitler represented the Third Reich. It is important to realize this title of beast is given by John as he views this empire and its evil king from a heavenly perspective. Remember, John's in heaven. He sees this beast, okay? And this is the divine description. Now, if you were to give me some kind of description of Adolf Hitler today, what would you say about him? Evil. What else? Mustache. What? Mustache. What else? Bad. Mad. Madman. Grotesque, terrible, evil. Just, I mean, all these negative things. Well, why would you say that? If you saw him in the day that he was around, guess what he looked like? Most people thought he was a pretty handsome dude and pretty smart and pretty talented. But from heaven's perspective, God sees the heart. And this beast from the outside is going to look pretty natural and good. In fact, as John gives this view from the empire from heaven, his descriptions are terrible. Were we to receive CNN's description or a report from 60 Minutes describing this man and his growing empire, it would be a glowing report of praise. From a human perspective, this man will be amazingly glorious and popular. From heaven's inerrant view, he is a beast. This description identifies his internal character, not his external appearance. Now, I've got this map here just for you to get an idea here. That is the Mediterranean Sea. Most of you have seen that before. And you can look at Italy there, the boot, and Greece, and Asia, Turkey, and Israel's way over on the far right. And so there's the Mediterranean Sea. Some of you just wonder how big this is Because this is going to be somewhere the beast is going to be around and controlling all of those countries around the Mediterranean Sea and perhaps a good part of the rest of the world. How big is the Mediterranean Sea? This map will help you to see it. It's about the size, it's at least about half the size of the United States of America. It's pretty large there. So you can see that image of the inside of the Mediterranean Sea inside of America. So that just gives you a clue as to what's going on there. Now, let's go on and look at this beast. He's also wild. Look at verse 2. And the beast, which I saw, was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and had great authority. So this beast is wild. He is dangerous. The Greek word for beast is dangerous animal, venomous and wild, to destroy. MacArthur says it does not refer to a domesticated animal, but to a wild, savage, vicious monster. Don't think this is a beast that you can tame and bring into your living room. He's dangerous. He's distinctive. The animal features combine the characteristics of the first three beasts of Daniel 7. Leopard-like swiftness, brutal, crushing power of the bear, and lion-like roar to create fear and paralysis in its victims. He is distinct. Thirdly, he is demonic. He is devilish. It tells us that the dragon gave him his power. He gets his authority and his power from the devil. So that gives you a clue that this is, whatever it is something the devil has orchestrated and created. The beast then is wounded. Notice what it says in verse 3, and I saw one of his heads as though it were wounded to death. And it was a deadly wound, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered at the beast. So there's this incident. Whatever it is some kind of a fatal wound, or at least it appears that way. It states it three times, and then again in chapter, in verse 12 and verse 14, talks that the wound was caused by a sword. So we still don't know exactly what it was and how it is. The recovery, it says, was as it were a deadly wound. It appears as though this will be a miraculous recovery, possibly even a resurrection. I tend to think it's probably not a full resurrection. I tend to think it is more like a staged event. Although I don't know for sure. God may apparently give the devil that power at that point, or he might do it himself. I don't know. But at any rate, there are some interpretations that abound in this thing. Some think it was Nero. Some think it Nero returned from the dead. Some think it's the Roman Empire. They believe this picture is not a person, but the revived Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is going to be revived, I believe, as we study the book of Daniel, but I don't think that is. Some think it's the Antichrist, and that's most likely the interpretation here. So most likely the Antichrist is going to receive some kind of deadly wound. Maybe it'll be similar to what happened in Pennsylvania, Butler, Pennsylvania, just a year ago when they tried to kill President Trump, and he did get hit. This guy apparently is going to get hit with a bullet or a sword or something. Somebody's going to try and take his life, and yet miraculously, or what is going to appear to the world as a miracle, he's going to survive or recover. So is it staged or real? I don't know, but there's various interpretations. But the impact is going to be amazing. The recovery will be so impressive, it will cause the world to wonder, it says, at the beast, it tells us in verse 3. The world wondered after the beast. That's a wonder that has the concept of, wow, this must be the Messiah, this must be our great hero. And it will create a sense of worship. And he will then, from that moment on, demand worship. It will be God-like worship. I'm your Savior. I'm your God. It'll be satanic worship. He demands it in verse 5. And it says, verse 4, and they worshiped the dragon who gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. So he is now demanding worship. It is satanic worship. It is willful worship. They're wondering after him, and they're saying, wow, and they just throw themselves at his feet. You know, they're going to be so enthralled with their new dictator and gladly accept his demands for worship. This may be difficult to imagine, but one only needs to look back at the masses of Germany yelling, Heil Hitler! How many of you have seen that? Thousands upon thousands were really worshiping him as their Führer. Hail my leader is what the German means. Or to the masses in China who bowed to Chairman Mao. And the world is looking for this kind of a leader that they can worship. And yet this will also be forced worship, as we see in verse 8. It says in verse 8, and all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life, the book of the life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. So it's forced worship as well. So some believers will apparently try to resist, but they will be like it happened in Daniel chapter 3 when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down before the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar built. What did Nebuchadnezzar do to those three guys? He killed them, right? He tried. He threw them in the fiery furnace, and God miraculously protected him. Obviously, this is going to happen, and God is not going to protect them. Maybe there will be some that God will protect. Who knows? But the beast demands worship. Not only does he demand worship, he will be very wicked. The beast is terribly wicked. Verse 5, it says, there were given him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. So there's blasphemy and his power and his focus in verse 6. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. So he is filled with blasphemy, and God allows him to have power. He's going to raise up and control much of the planet. And this is the devil's final hurrah. He is going out after everything. He's just taken the whole world, and God is allowing him to do it at that time. Anything and everything that has to do with God, he blasphemes. And John Phillips says, Satan will achieve his goal of unifying the nations, dazzling some, browbeating others, cementing the whole rickety structure together with the mortar of the indulgence of every evil passion and the epoxy of horrible, merciless, unrelenting persecution. The devil is going to bring his whole beastly empire together to oppose God, to persecute any of God's people that he can, including Christians and Jews. The beast makes war. In verse 7, look at this. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given unto him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. God allowed him to have that power against his people. Then it's not only against his people, it says, it goes on to say, and power was given to him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. So it's not just his people, it is over the whole world. He is now showing his capacity of evil. They wanted to worship the beast, and now he's going to show them how wicked and evil he can be. And then finally, there is this warning that we see about the beast. In verses 9 and 10, if any man have an ear to hear, if any man have an ear, let him hear. And this is not to the churches. You remember we pointed out that here it is, that same formula that we heard seven times to the churches in verses 2 and 3. There is no church in the tribulation. The church is in heaven. But he says to the entire world, if any man has an ear to hear, let him hear. And here's what he better hear, verse 10. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with a sword must be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So there's a formula given. The formula is whoever uses the sword to kill will die by the sword. Jesus said that to Peter. Put your sword up when Peter tried to protect him there in the Garden of Eden, or in the Garden of Gethsemane, excuse me. And Peter was going to fight for him, and Jesus said, put your sword up, for all who use the sword will die by the sword. Here he's saying the same thing. Those that are involved in murder here will die the death of murderers. And then he gives them the application here. Have a strong faith and patience. Be strong. This is the time for Christians, believers in the tribulation, to have a strong faith and to be patient. Perseverance to overcome. The patience that they need to have is in only in strength, is only in Christ. A guy by the name of Boris Kornfeld was a Jewish doctor who was imprisoned in one of the death camps in the Soviet Gulag years ago. And he refused to cooperate with the Marxist-Lenin and his tortures. And as a result, he didn't live very long. He lived only long enough to witness to one other prisoner. But he did it. He was taken and he was brutally murdered. He was a doctor at that prison camp, and he was supposed to be doing that, and they incarcerated him and they persecuted him. He said, "What you're doing is wrong, and I'll not participate in it." The one person that he witnessed to soon became a Christian. And as a result of his witness, he multiplied that influence and that conversion over and over again. Many others in that prison became believers also. The patient's name was Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the one that wrote the books about the Gulag. Became a Nobel Prize writing author. And we're going to see, I think, a lot of testimonies in the tribulation of people like that that are to be faithful and to keep their testimony open, and people will get saved as a result of that. Now, I think I gave you a paragraph at the end there. The title beast is used in the most ominous way in Revelation 13. It is used to describe two related objects, an evil empire and the empire's evil king. Both describe the internal characteristics, not the external appearances. Remember that. The beast of Revelation 13 does not look like a killer, but he is possessed by Satan, the grand murderer from the beginning. And we've given you a list of names of the devil's tyrant, the titles of the Antichrist: Little Horn, Prince, Abomination of Desolation, Man of Sin, Son of Perdition, the Wicked One, Antichrist, and Beast. Now let's come to this section, the Mark of the Beast, which people are always wondering about. Oh, you want an application. The application is that they need to be strong and have faith and be patient there. That's right. I'm sorry I didn't give that to you. Everybody got her? All right, let's move on. The Mark of the Beast. Everybody wants to know, what's the mark of the beast? On July 24th in 2017, there was an article that came out in a paper, and the title of the article was this: Wisconsin Company to Install Rice-Sized Microchips in Employees. Anybody got one of them pieces of rice in you? It's the mark of the beast. If you got it, you're going to die, right? I don't know. We'll see. Let's go through this text and find out what it is. All right, so there are some key identification factors of the beast. First of all, we see his manners. His manners. They are similar. They're similar to the beast. Okay, in verse 11, "And I beheld another beast." There it is, another beast. So it's a second beast. And notice it says he's coming up out of the earth also. So he is like the first beast in the same way. They're two of a kind is what they are. Both of them come up out of the planet Earth. One comes out of the sea of humanity. The other comes out of the earth in some way. And that's as opposed to coming from heaven. So this is not an angel. This is another beast. The first beast also came from the earth and the sea. But this one is similar, but he is separate. He does say another beast. And this one has two horns, it says in verse 11. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. So he's got some similarities, but he is separate. This one is a spiritual beast because he is like a lamb. Gentle and mild, not like the leopard and the bear and the lion. He's identified later on as the false prophet. And he is a religious leader. So this one is going to be the part that makes up this Holy Trinity. And he speaks, however, like a dragon. So though he acts like a lamb, he is a wolf in sheep's clothing. So this is the reverend, the minister, the religious leader that the whole world is going to say, wow, this is what a godly man and a wonderful holy person this is. By the way, I think I gave you a little chart there, didn't I? This describes this unholy Trinity, the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon. The devil tries to mimic heaven's Trinity, where we have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The devil has his dragon, his beast, and his false prophet. And so they are trying to, he's trying to mimic and look just like heaven here. So let's look at his might. How powerful is this man? Verse 12 says, and he exercises all the power of the first beast before him and causes the earth and them who dwell on it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So he's got a shared power with the beast. And it is not only shared, but we find out that it is also satanic, because it's the power. Where did the first beast get his power? From the devil, from the dragon. And so that tells us, of course, that he is very strong. He is the agent of conversion. And notice what it says. He dwells and causes the whole earth and them who dwell on it to worship the first beast. So he comes along as the minister and says, here's our great Messiah. Worship him. Notice he is able to do miracles in verse 13. And he doeth great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Wow, that's pretty dramatic, I'd say, wouldn't you? Like Elijah. Some are going to no doubt say, wow, this man is just like Elijah. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. That is only God can do that. But he's also very deceptive. Notice verse 14. And he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth, and they that make an image to the beast, and that they and had the wound by a sword and did live. So he's very deceptive. And he's also demonic. That's how he can do these miracles. Verse 15, and he hath power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. What is this image of the beast? We cannot know what it is for sure, although there's no shortage of speculations on this one. People go all over the map and they, well, you know, we know we've got AI and artificial intelligence today, and we've got these robotics peoples, and so it's giving life, and this is going to, they've got actually servants and robots that are built now that look like human beings, and it's to the point where sometimes you can't tell the difference between a human being and a robot the way they've perfected those in some cases. And maybe that's what it's talking about. We don't know what it's going to be. But it invokes the image and the reminder of that event in Revelation, or in Daniel chapter 3, where Nebuchadnezzar made a great image and made everybody bow down to that image. This one is going to be more impressive from the standpoint that it's going to be alive. Maybe it'll be a huge giant thing, I don't know, like Nebuchadnezzar's. It says he has power to give life, and the Greek word there is a little different. It doesn't have the idea of the kind of life that you and I have. Only God can do that. But this man is given some kind of authority and power to give some kind of life into that image. The impression is given that this image is alive, and it has breath and it speaks. Perhaps it moves about also. Maybe some kind of demonic robot, but a very impressive image, whatever it is, I don't know. His miracles, however, are designed with the purpose that everyone should worship this beast or be killed. It's forced worship. Either you get down or you die. You get thrown in the fiery furnace or whatever. Deja vu all over again, isn't it? The devil just doesn't seem to change his tactics. Now, here's we're going to find out the mark. Where is this mark? In verse 16, it says, "And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and enslaved, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell except he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666, 666. So the mark is mandatory. Everybody's got to get it, or you can't buy or sell. You're going to die. It's mysterious. Not everybody understands exactly what this mark is, and there's a lot of, you know, speculation about it. Is it a tattoo? Is it a microchip? Is it a special credit card? Is it a universal passport? Is it a bracelet? A lanyard? Something like the Star of David? The practice of branding has been going on for centuries. This is a form of branding which identifies to whom people belong. If you don't get the mark, you do not belong to the empire. You will be ostracized, rejected, and ultimately killed. Some claim that it is a spiritual mark. But the text indicates it is a very literal and to be received in one of two locations. How do you get a spiritual mark in your forehead? How do you get a spiritual mark in your hand? I think it's something visible. The name of the beast, some think it's what is put on there. Apparently, the number 666 finds significant meaning in the name of the beast. Maybe some think it's going to be the mark, the number 666 tattooed on your hand or your forehead. There's a lot of speculation about who this is and who this guy is, Nero, the Antichrist, the number of the Antichrist. Martin Luther, Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, Richard Nixon, and just about every president since. They said it was Ronald Reagan and Clinton, Obama and Trump. Did anybody ever say it was Biden? Probably. Various scientists, labor unions, social security numbers, on and on we go. We don't know. But it's some kind of mark, and I think it's probably a very literal mark that will be visible in the forehead or the hand. And you can get your choice. Some people don't want to ruin their looks with something on their face. Of course, if you're that boxer, what's his name, that got the ugly tattoo on his face, and he says, "I wasn't liking the way my face was looking." And so he made it more ugly. Yeah, who was it?
Mike Tyson,
yeah, that's right. Some people can't improve their looks, I guess. I don't know. They try, though. Man's mark is what it is. It's the mark of man, the mark of the beast. is the first beast, forcing all people to make a clear decision. And so the Greek word for mark, by the way, literally, I checked it out, the word is carefully, whether engraved or imprinted or branded, it means a meaningful mark. A strictly literal translation of the mark of the beast might imply a picture of the beast. Might it actually be a picture? Or a mark made by the beast. A more satisfactory indication of the relationship between mark and beast would be a mark showing one's relationship to the beast, a mark of loyalty to the beast, or a mark of the party of the beast. So, the mark of the beast. There's a lamb on Mount Zion, and it's very interesting that the very next scene we come to is after having seen the mark of the beast, guess what? There's another mark here. Look at it in verse 1 of chapter 14. It says, "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads." How about that? They got a mark too. It's not of the beast, it's of the Lord himself. How about that? So the devil's trying to counter the mark of Christ. You sealed your people with a mark. I'm going to seal my people with a mark. And we're going to just really, you know, fight it out, duke it out at the end. So we've got this historical victory scene here in a moment here. And we see the presence of the Lamb. And he's standing with his people. He stands up. So that tells us that he's ready to go to battle now. And his seal is upon them. His name is written in their foreheads. This coincides with the seal of God. He protected them through the tribulation. Now he stands with them in victory, and it's most likely with them in a place that is close to the earth. And I'm moving quickly here, can you tell? There's the place of the Lamb. Where is he? It says Mount Zion is what it says in verse 1. Somebody think it's a heavenly city. And then some of us think it's Jerusalem. A prophetic vision anticipating the soon coming victorious march into Jerusalem at the beginning of the millennium. 144 have just been rescued from the planned extermination of Antichrist. That rescue comes through the battle of Armageddon. So what does that induce for them? It induces a moment of great praise. Praise to the Lamb. There is a voice from heaven, and the harps are playing, and there's a new song. Verse 2, "And I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of the harpers harping with their harps, and they sang as it were a new song before the throne and before the living creatures and elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are they who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. They who follow the Lamb wherever he goeth. These are the redeemed from among men, and the first fruits of God into the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no guile, and they are without fault before the throne of God." So this group is an amazing group, and the purity is described for us. They're undefiled, and they're disciples, they're redeemed. They are the first fruits, and they had pure mouths. I think I gave you all that, didn't I? I figured by this time I'd be rushing really fast, so I wanted to move on here. So let's go on then to the purity of the Lamb in verses 4 and 5. And did I give you that too as well? All right, so it invites conversion. Okay, we're at the everlasting gospel. Did I miss a sheet? You all got those, right? You had everything? We good? All right, so now we're coming to, where are we at here? Verse 6. "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell upon the earth, and every nation and kindred and tongue and people." So it invites conversion. It is external, and it is eternal, and extended. He's offering this eternal gospel, verse 7, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, for an hour, the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of the waters." So he extends this invitation to the universe. And then it is evidential. What happens when a person gets saved? They fear God and they glorify God. So that's what he tells them to do. Fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment has come. So that is what they need to do. And they fear God and worship God. And this is also expositional, because it's revealing. Two reasons are given for these commands. Judgment is coming, and God is the true creator. So that's why we invite conversion. Judgment is coming. God is the true creator. Get your life right with him. It also includes condemnation. All right? It includes condemnation of Babylon. Verse 8, And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen the great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So there's a judgment of Babylon. There is the identity of Babylon in verse 8 and the inclusion with Babylon. Babylon goes way back to the beginning. Again, here is a kind of a panoramic view of the capital city that the devil is going to make as his headquarters as he opposes God at the very end. And there's a lot of details and a lot of debate about this. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because in the end, I'm just not sure, and I don't think anybody can be sure about it. But there is no doubt a capital that is going to be his capital, and he wants it to fight against God. So there is the condemnation of Babylon. There is also the condemnation of beast followers in verse 9. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and of the faith of Jesus Christ. The beast followers, the offenders are identified, those that have the mark in their head or their hand. The horror is detailed here, and I think I gave those to you, didn't I? It's unmixed torment, it's unbelievable torment, it is unending torment, and it is something that is unacceptable for somebody to teach otherwise. And people do that. They try to make hell out to be less than what it is. And hell is a horrible, horrible thing, and so it's imperative that all of us understand that. So the next thing we come to is then the comfort in verses 12 and 13. He says to be patient. I give that to you as well. And to persevere, all right? Let's look at the Battle of Armageddon, and I think we can get through this at this time. You got all that, right? All right, so it's you know, I got going on my alliteration in that text, and it's all true. Good stuff there. All right, Armageddon. Two metaphors are used to depict this final battle. Some believers see these figures as something, they both of them describe the same battle. We got to remember that. But some see these two different phases as of the final battle. It is difficult to say for sure, but the ripe word in verse 15, the word that says ripe, is different from verse 18, where it means that something is different. So there are two different pictures here, and let's look at them. All right, verse 14 says, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. So there is a grain harvest, first of all. And who is the personnel for this? It says reapers. There's a reaper that looks like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat in the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. So I think from this we hear that one sat there and then another one came out that was another angel. So I'm thinking this is probably an angel. But the process here tells him that to gather, and so it's a grain harvest picture here. He takes that sickle and he puts it in there. So the picture is of the description that Jesus talked about in the parables in Matthew 13, where the parable of the tares and the wheat, let them grow until the end, and the angels, it says, will come and harvest them, and he'll separate the tares from the wheat. The second picture is a picture of a grape harvest. In verse 18, and another angel came out from the altar who had power over fire and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in the sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. The personnel, again, is angels. The process, thrust in the sickle, harvest the cluster of grapes, and thrust them, it says, into the winepress of the wrath of God. And it talks about what happens in that winepress in verse 20. And the winepress, it says, was trodden outside of the city. So that picture, that word trodden, has this picture of trampling down. It's the practice that they did in the old days when they harvested the grapes, and they got in there in their bare feet, and they would stomp on the grapes and squish them until the grape juice ran out in a slough, and they would then capture it. The product, however, here, it tells us what it is in verse 20. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress. This is the first time it tells us now exactly what it is. It's not wine that comes out of those, it's blood. And the blood, it says, even unto the horse's bridle, by the space of 1,600 furlongs, about 180 miles. So it is blood that's coming out of that. There's much debate about the literal interpretation of this river of blood. And I gave you everything on there so that you could read it. And if you have a question about that, it'll give you the details about this Battle of Armageddon. And here is the place it's going to take place, folks, right here. I'm at Mount Carmel, and there's the battle, the field right there. It is huge. That's where the Battle of Armageddon is going to take place. What an awesome privilege to stand there and just imagine the millions of soldiers that will be gathered down to that field and where God will slay them, and the blood will come running and into a river. And that's what we're looking at, the Battle of Armageddon.